We have plenty. We have gathered into bars, done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories. We were there in the mills. We were there in the mines and came home to fix the meals. We were there on the picket line. We raised our voices loud. It makes me proud just knowing.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
It is a major milestone in American democracy, full stop. But it was not a complete victory.
Right.
And women were not enfranchised in one fell swoop. They still aren't enfranchised, right?
That's Robin Muncy, history professor at the University of Maryland. She curated an exhibit at the National Archives titled Rightfully Hers, American Women and the Vote. It celebrates the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which was ratified by Congress on August 18, 1920. Dr. Muncy sat down with our mini labor archives team last week to talk about the role organized labor played in the lengthy and difficult struggle for women's rights. We'll also hear from Saul Schneiderman about the origins of Women's History Month, which begins today. Here's the show.
Everyone, welcome to a special edition of Cool Things here in the Media Archives. In addition to having Ben Blake, labor archivist, Chloe Daniel, our student assistant, and myself, Alan, the archive specialist, we are here with a very special guest, Professor Robin Muncy from the University of Maryland's History Department. Dr. Muncy was a guest on Labor History Today back in March of last year, where she spoke about her article on the strange history of the working class. Professor Muncy is also considered an expert on women's suffrage. And she recently collaborated with Dr. Marjorie Spruill, a history professor at the University of South Carolina, on an exhibit titled Rightfully Hers, American Women and the Vote, on display at the National Archives through January 3rd, 2021. So we've brought Professor Muncy here today to discuss a suffrage voting rights exhibit that is going on display here in the ground floor of Hornbeck Library at the University of Maryland over the summer. Thank you so much, Dr. Muncy, for being here with us today.
I am thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I guess to start, what is the role of the working class in the suffrage movement?
That is such a fantastic and important question, and so few people have asked it. I think that the general public has no idea that of the importance of the working class to the suffrage struggle. In fact, this early 20th century woman suffrage struggle is often represented as a middle-class white movement, which it absolutely was not. And I think the hardest sell in putting together the exhibit that I put together and in other public history projects that I've been a part of in the last couple of years, actually the hardest sell is getting the working class into the story. So I'm really excited to have this opportunity to talk a little bit about what I see as the role of the working class in the women's suffrage movement in the early 20th century. And what I will say in general is that the working class was absolutely crucial to the women's suffrage movement in order to have the victories that the women's suffrage movement had in the early 20th century. The movement had to be a mass movement.
Right.
That's what it took. And it didn't become a mass movement really until the 1910s. And it became a mass movement because the working class came to support it, right? It is the participation of the working class in the 1910s that especially made the woman suffrage movement a mass movement. And the movement will, as a result, have multiple major victories, first at the state level and then with the 19th Amendment in that decade. I would love to give you just a few examples.
Absolutely.
Of what I'm talking about here. So there's a woman named Maggie Hinchey, Margaret Hinchey, an Irish immigrant in the late 19th century. She goes to work in New York City as a laundry worker. And in 1912, she leads a huge strike of laundry workers in New York City, at least according to the press, 30,000 workers out on strike. It's a successful strike. She forms a union of laundry workers, and she proudly carries that union card for the rest of the decade. So that's 1912. By 1913, she had become also a major suffrage activist because she was making the argument that if working women were ever going to improve their conditions of labor, if they were going to get better wages and safe conditions, they had to have the vote. They had to be able to threaten politicians at the polls. And she was so successful and so compelling as a suffrage speaker that the Wage Earners Suffrage League, which was affiliated with the Women's Suffrage Party in New York City, hired her in 1913. And she left the laundry temporarily for several years to be a full-time suffrage activist. She was an organizer for suffrage, Maggie Hinchey. And her renown spread across the country so that in 1914, when Montanans, I'm not sure that's really a word, the people in Montana were about to vote on a referendum on women's suffrage, 1914, the leaders of the suffrage movement got a hold of Maggie Hinchey and said, could you come? We've got to have working men voting yes on this referendum or this can't pass. So Maggie Hinchey goes from New York City to Montana and spends multiple weeks in the fall of 1914 speaking to working class, especially working class crowds. And in the fall of 1914, the referendum passed and women in Montana were enfranchised on the same basis as men.
Wow.
Yeah, really pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And then you get it. There's a similar story for Nevada, same year, in fact. Nevada is also in 1914 facing a referendum. The suffrage leaders in the state are concerned that they've got to get working class men from the mining camps and from small towns and people working on the railroads. They've got to get those guys on board. And so they're trying to find who would be the best person to do this. And there's a hat trimmer. This is another Maggie. This is Maggie Foley, Margaret Foley, in Boston, who also had achieved a certain renown for her effectiveness with working class communities. And so the suffrage leaders in Nevada asked Maggie Foley, could she please come and spend a couple of months going from mining camp and mining camp to small town in Nevada, trying to convince working class men to vote for suffrage. And she went out for 2 months. And again, Nevada in 1914, fully enfranchised women in Nevada. That was women are enfranchised in 1914 on the same basis as men. And then I'll just give you one more example. We could go on and on, but I'll just give you one more example. I'll shift from the West to the East to New York, where, of course, Maggie Hinchey is working her heart out beginning in 1913 to convince working class men in New York, and not just in New York City. She's making trips to Buffalo and upstate. She's going everywhere. In fact, there's one newspaper article in which she reported a day in Buffalo when she must have drunk 60 cups of tea as she tried to convince, you know, was talking to one group after another, drinking their tea and trying to convince them to support suffrage. Anyhow, Maggie Hinchey is doing things in New York City like going to the piers and talking to longshoremen. And her work there and success there is reported in the New York Times. She is heading down into the trenches where the guys are digging the subway, right, on 8th Avenue, and trying to convince these guys from all nationalities to vote for women's suffrage and why they've got to come through. She goes to the Bowery. She's talking, and there's, again, it's this fantastic New York Times report on her work in the Bowery, where at one point she was described as being so affecting that every man succumbed in the Bowery, succumbed to the cause of women's suffrage, because Maggie is so compelling. So Maggie Hinchey is doing her work in 1915, 1916, 1917 in New York, but she is so not alone because New York has this huge, huge community of women who are labor activists and huge supporters of suffrage. And they include people that you will know, people like Rose Schneiderman, people like Clara Lemlich, people like Pauline Newman, all three of them, of course, Eastern European immigrants active in organizing International Ladies Garment Workers Union and the New York Women's Trade Union League. All of them major supporters of suffrage, and they had been, you know, before 1910. And they're really getting some steam up by the time we get to the teens. Leonora O'Reilly, also absolutely crucial suffrage activist. Leonora O'Reilly was also a garment worker. She had come from Ireland in the late 19th century, and she was one of the founders of the National Women's Trade Union League in 1903. And the Trade Union League becomes a major supporter of suffrage a few years later. But she organized in 1911 the Wage Earner Suffrage League in New York.
Right.
It was not the first local Wage Earner Suffrage League. As I understand it, the first one was out in California, maybe San Francisco, in 1908,
Whoa.
Which I would like to learn a whole lot more about.
That's, yeah, I would not expect that at all.
Yeah, really super interesting. And my understanding is that it was a woman of German descent who okay. was the founder of that group out in San Francisco. So I'd love to put somebody on that. Anyway, Leonore O'Reilly organizes the Wage Earner Suffrage League in New York in 1911. She goes before Congress to make the case that working class women need the vote and maybe need it more than even other women because they need to be able to improve their working conditions. And Leonora O'Reilly also is somebody who helped women in other cities also form wage earner suffrage leagues. Like they would come to her and she would advise them how to get a group together and what they could do and who they needed to talk to and that sort of thing. So New York is just lousy with important working class women labor leaders who are suffrage supporters. And they succeed, of course, in 1917 in winning a referendum for women's suffrage in New York. And so New York becomes the first Eastern state to enfranchise women on the same basis as men, 1917.
Right.
Yeah.
So, what were some of the arguments that some of these organizers made to working class men that women deserve the right to vote?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. They made the argument that having working women voting would benefit the class. Not only was it crucial for working class women, working women, wage earning women, because they needed the vote in order to improve their conditions of labor. In fact, there are these fantastic posters and speeches and even published articles. Like Clara Lemlich publishes an article in 1911 in Good Housekeeping. Describing what the conditions at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory were like, and then it must be after 1911. It must be a little bit later than that.
Yeah.
And then, but in the what she concludes at the end of that article about the conditions in the garment industry in New York is that wage earning women need the vote, right? And they need it because why would the bosses ever listen to them when they're demanding better conditions? Why would legislators in Albany, why would they listen to working women who say that we need protections? Because they haven't got the vote, the guys are never going to listen to them. But they say also to their working class compatriots, they say, and this is important for the class. When we vote, we give more power, more electoral power, more voting power to the working class. This is not just about us. It's about the whole community. So they're very, very adamant that women's suffrage is a working class issue.
I guess stemming from that, one question that I had, well, first of all, I'm kind of curious about Good Housekeeping, like the audience of the publication itself. Is that, was it a working class publication? Or because I've always thought of it as kind of like a middle upper class publication. So hearing an article like that appearing in Good Housekeeping at that time is kind of mind-blowing, because it's almost like a working class effort to galvanize middle class women.
That is exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was. It is a very clear plea by Lemlich on behalf of wage earning women to middle class women to support their efforts in organizing, as in doing labor organizing, but also to support the vote, because here we need this worse than anybody else. It's an incredibly powerful article. And we excerpted part of it and made a kind of graphic of it for the suffrage exhibit
to
the
National
Archives.
That's
awesome. It's so powerful, yeah.
So I guess shifting from the history itself to how the history is portrayed in an exhibit, mm-hmm. How have you seen labor and, you know, labor collections depicted in exhibits on voting rights and suffrage?
Right. On women's suffrage, I think there has been precious little. I mean, one of the things that's really exciting about what you're going to be doing here at Hornbeck Library, and I think something that's going to be happening maybe down at the Belmont Paul House, I think there's something in the works down there, is that labor will be central to the story. And at the National Archives exhibit on suffrage, we included working class women and the importance of the labor movement and labor tactics, labor organizing as models for suffrage organizing. Because so many of the women, of course, who are working class activists are working for suffrage in the same way that they organized workers at the workplace. So the tactics, methods of the labor movement are definitely coming into the suffrage movement directly through the participation of working class women. And that is in our exhibit, for instance. But the other exhibits that I've seen so far actually haven't included the working class or organized labor at all.
Hmm.
They've been absolutely absent.
Wow.
And so, yes, that's why I mentioned this. I mean, I'm on the advisory board for this Votes for Women Trail project, which aims to put... Super interesting. Aims to put these markers, historical markers, at least 5 per state is the goal. I don't know if we'll make it, marking places that are important to the history of suffrage. And so there are people, you know, volunteers out in the states working desperately to try to identify these sites and figure out which are the most important ones and get permission to put something up on people's property. I mean, it's a huge undertaking. But, and it's not hard to get everybody to think that it's important to have not only white women, but women of color represented right. in those sites. But convincing people that there even were working class women and that there should be sites that are devoted to the suffrage activity of working class women has been a really hard sell.
How so?
You know, you'll say, okay, so this is a great list you've got for Illinois. But of course, Illinois is a hotbed of labor activism, and you can't find anywhere where you'd have more working class women involved in the suffrage struggle than in Chicago. And the Chicago Federation of Labor, of course, is supportive of women's suffrage in Illinois. It's an integral part of the coalition for suffrage in Illinois. And I can even give you some names.
Please.
I'll give you some names. Emma Steghagen is a boot and shoe worker, really important in her union. She's really important in the Women's Trade Union League. She forms a wage earners suffrage league, really important in winning suffrage in Illinois. Agnes Nestor,
right.
Glove Workers Union. She is going to Springfield to lobby the state legislature before 1910. She continues to be a suffrage activist, you know, for years to come. And Elizabeth, I think it's Elizabeth Maloney, is in the Waitresses Union in Chicago. She is also a major suffrage activist. So, I mean, you have a really interesting variety. Mary Anderson
right.
is in Chicago. I think she's boot and shoe as well.
Yeah.
And Mary Anderson is not only a suffrage activist there in the early teens in Chicago, but she's going to go on and become the head of the Women's Bureau in the Federal Department of Labor for decades.
Yeah.
She's going to be at the center of the national coalition that's trying to improve the working conditions of laboring women. These are all women in Chicago. And so far, we don't have a site yet connected with working class women in Illinois. And it's not because people don't care, aren't willing to work. I just think it's hard for anybody to hear that working class women are involved.
I'm really struggling to think of why that is, though, especially in a city like Chicago, where they are so prevalent.
Do you think it has to do with the refusal to recognize class as an important category of social organization in the U.S.?
Even, I think on a national scale, perhaps, but thinking about a city like Chicago, I still have doubts. I think that Dunn, you have...
Chicago has no labor archives. The Chicago Historical Society has very limited labor collections. In fact, the steelworkers, for example, the steelworkers created their own archive because there was so little being documented about working class history in the city.
That's a very valid point. I didn't know that. And
really
didn't even
interesting. So it's out of memory. We've lost the memory.
Because I've always kind of seen Chicago as this essentially godless city built on labor. putting it very bluntly and perhaps an oversimplification, but...
And very much a labor town.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we were talking earlier, the resolution in 1890 before the AFL, American Federation of Labor Convention for Suffrage, came out of Chicago. One of the representatives from the Chicago Federation of Labor put forward the resolution and it was voted on. And that would be something that could be a landmark, the site of where the Chicago Federation of Labor met.
Do you know where it was?
I'd have to track
that
down.
But we could find out.
There would be, I'm trying to think, there's where the Federation itself met. It would have been a actual office, probably auditorium, for the Federation itself,
right?
That would have been where they would have debated suffrage and voted on that before it came to the National Convention?
I have suggested the headquarters of the Federation, the Chicago Federation of Labor, because I mean, there are all kinds. We can document loads of meetings, you know, where women were making the case for suffrage, where the guys have voted, oh, yes, of course, we're supporting suffrage. I mean, they send people, you know, to Springfield. This group is walking the walk. They're not just talking the talk. So it's just, it would be crazy for us not to have at least one marker. I mean, we even know places like, I think it was in 1909, I may have this wrong, but I think it was 1909, Agnes Nestor makes this train trip down from Chicago to Springfield, where she's going to lobby. And she stops at train stations along the way to make speeches for suffrage as she goes. And we can document those train stations.
Yeah.
And say, look, Joliet, Illinois, let's have a marker there. Why not in Springfield? You know, to mark the wild diversity of women who are there and their partners, their men partners, are there lobbying for suffrage. So there are great sites there. I think that surely we will eventually have these marked. But it's very interesting to me that this is just harder to get action on than other categories of difference.
It makes me wonder a little bit, what do you think maybe could be the importance of biography in this? If there is kind of an absence in the historical record, does it make it more important to study people like Agnes Nestor and Clara Lienlink because we have so few stories to go from, like, should we kind of look deeper into more specific people?
I think it's a very good idea. And I think it's one of the ways you actually begin to get a fuller picture of what's going on. So you can go to, say, Chronicling America, you know, that collection of newspapers, and put in Agnes Nestor and start pulling her up in small town newspapers. You can go to the Chicago Tribune. You know, since we have digitized newspapers now, it's just incredible. So you get a few names and you can begin to pull these folks up and follow them around. I mean, it's one of the ways that I learned about Maggie Foley, for instance, you know, this hat trimmer from Massachusetts. I learned about her from Tara McCarthy's fabulous book on Irish women's activism in the early 20th century. So I thank Tara McCarthy for that fabulous book. I was so curious about her then that I began to put her name into various digitized newspapers. And you know, she's coming up all over the place. And I learned more about her by seeing what the Christian Science Monitor is reporting about her and what these little bitty newspapers in Nevada are reporting about her. And then Boston, she goes back and she is interviewed by newspapers in Boston and she's telling her story there. And then the people in Nevada think, oh my gosh, she's representing us as this wild, uncouth West. We don't want to be represented like that. And she said, oh my gosh, guns everywhere. And she's telling stories about even having slept rough on the trips around these camps and even having spent some time on Indian reservations. And those of us who are doing this work are super interested in this because, of course, Indians on reservations generally didn't have the vote at all.
Right.
And yet she's definitely reporting that among the people she's talking to are Native Americans. And so what exactly is going on there? We don't know and need to find out. Huh. Super interesting. So yes, when you get individual names of people, wow, that opens up all kinds of sort of circuits of connections and networks and ideas that you wouldn't ever have guessed were there.
And also, I think being mindful of kind of how, especially within labor archives, that men seem to dominate the historical record, and knowing that a lot of these working class women were out speaking to predominantly working class male audiences, perhaps there's a lens and perhaps some of the gap can be filled if some of these men reported on, you know, being in the audience, if some of their sentiments resonated with them or something like that, perhaps that can help provide additional information for things that we don't really know.
Right. So. You bet. It might help us know where to look and when to look, you know, what point to look.
I really agree with that, because if you look at the AFL-CIO records, so the civil rights movement begins to be documented really well from the 1930s on, mm-hmm. because you have, you know, A. Philip Randolph, you have the formal structures, Committee Against Discrimination, and then later the Civil Rights Department, which we have these amazing records and huge records on that. But we don't have the same thing for women, partly resources, but also partly the history, where you don't really, it's not till CLU is found, Coalition Labor Union Women is founded, that you really start having a lot more documentation, which is way later. You know, you're talking 1970s versus the 30s. So, again, what we were talking about earlier, this kind of the gaps that are in the historic record, the kind of erasure that goes on due to what Alan was talking about, where you just don't have the recognition of the importance of the women's contribution to the labor movement.
Right. I mean, I do think that that digitized newspapers are a huge help, and it is a place to look. One of the things that I have found so incredibly fun and exciting in the last just couple of months is you can find these, like Maggie Hinchy, you know, going into the trenches where the guys are digging the subway. And you think, okay, well, not all those guys are organized, right? In fact, probably most of them aren't.
Right.
And so you're seeing, you know, a working class woman talking to working class men outside the labor movement. It's an even broader group. And it's amazing what gets captured in something like the New York Times. And I thank you so much.
and that brings up to me, you were talking about Montana in 1914. The industrial workers of the world were still strong, and Butte, Montana, of course, huge iron ore mining region that the IWW had, and Western Federation of Miners had this tremendous tradition. But their politics were not to engage in, you know, elections and participate in the government. So I'm wondering, have you got any hints of how that plays out?
That's a fantastic question. I don't, actually, but it's a really interesting question. And it's an interesting question in the West and other places where the IWW is strong. It's also, it seems especially important and interesting to study particular ethnic groups. So for instance, there's this fantastic book, Jennifer Guglielmo's book called Living the Revolution, on Italian women workers in the early 20th century. And you know, one of the reasons that women's historians haven't known as much about Italian women workers and their organizational activities, and especially their suffrage activities, is because a lot are anarchists. And so they're not working on suffrage, right? Like they've got a different politics. And so they're going to focus someplace else. And so they get dropped out or harder to see. They're harder to see for kind of traditional women's historians even. So that's a fantastically interesting question.
We'll be back with our conversation with University of Maryland history professor Robin Muncy in a moment. Here's Saul Schneiderman on the origins of Women's History Month and a special PBS show celebrating that history. Something about
the women. Hi, this is Saul Schneiderman calling from Tacoma Park to alert Labor History Today listeners about a PBS television special that's going to be aired the first week of March to celebrate Women's History Month. And the program is called Rise Up, the Songs of the Women's Movement. And listeners will need to check your local PBS stations for the schedule. Social movements, especially here in the United States, have historically been fueled by music and other art forms. The labor movement, the civil rights movement, the women's movement have all used music to inspire people and to rally the troops. As film director Boots Riley once said, culture tills the soil and gets people ready for political action. Now, the origin for Women's History Month is really fascinating. It began as a commemoration of a Women's History Day, which started in New York in the early 1900s, primarily by the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union, as they organized workers to strike and protest against oppressive working conditions in the garment industry. Much of the leadership in the early days of the ILGWU was socialist, and so it wasn't surprising that in 1909, and actually through 1913, the Socialist Party of America celebrated a Women's Day, primarily for working women. This spread to Europe when in 1910 an international conference of working women was held in Copenhagen. And women unionists and socialists from around the world attended, and a German delegate by the name of Clara Zetkin proposed that March 8th be a day to honor working women. This is where International Women's Day came about. The next year in Europe, marches and demonstrations were held, and it took until 1975 when the United Nations began celebrating a Women's History Day. In the United States, the idea became popularized during the 70s by the women's movement, the so-called second wave feminists. President Carter designated the first week in May in 1980 as a Women's History Week. States began calling for Women's History Month and having commemorations, and finally it was designated by the U.S. Congress, March is Women's History Month in the United States. So let's all celebrate the accomplishments of women and their struggle for liberation. Tune into PBS the first week in March for Rise Up, the Songs of the Women's Movement. Something about
the women. Join us for Rise Up, Songs of the Women's Movement that celebrates the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. It features Aretha Franklin, Cyndi Lauper, Tina Turner, Annie Lennox, Melissa Etheridge, Joan Jett, Gloria Gaynor, Janice Ian, and others, and the songs that inspired and were inspired by the women who changed history.
Back now to our conversation with Robin Munsey, history professor at the University of Maryland. She curated an exhibit at the National Archives titled Rightfully Hers, American Women and the Vote, that celebrates the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Dr. Munsey sat down with our Armenian Labor Archives team last week to talk about the role organized labor played in the lengthy and difficult struggle for women's rights.
So I guess, you know, kind of moving forward, one of the many things that I've recognized from your work is that one of the important takeaways in the struggle for women's suffrage is that it's essentially far from over, is that for all its significance, the 19th Amendment did not enfranchise American women. Millions of American women had at least partial suffrage before 1920. Millions were still barred from the polls after 1920. Millions still remain barred from voting today. So putting this into a current context, how do you see this history kind of playing out now in the 21st century? What sort of connections do you make?
Yeah, so fantastic. So I just want to repeat what you said, because I think it is the most important thing we can pass along about the meaning of the 19th Amendment, which I think during this year when we're celebrating the centennial, I think we don't want to take anything away from the 19th Amendment. It is a major milestone in American democracy. Full stop. But it was not a complete victory.
Right.
And women were not enfranchised in one fell swoop. They still aren't enfranchised, right? And so knowing that there were millions of women enfranchised before the 19th Amendment by state action in places like Montana and Nevada and New York, right? In fact, there are 15 states that had enfranchised women on the same basis as men before the 19th Amendment, and another 12 before the ratification of the 19th Amendment, another 12 states women had at least presidential suffrage.
Okay.
So that means that in over half of the states, because there are 48 states at that point, in 27 of them before the ratification of the 19th Amendment, women were voting at least for presidential electors. And it's that kind of political power that makes the 19th Amendment possible. Right? Because guys in Congress are either being voted directly, being voted for by women voters, or candidates in their political party are going to be facing women electors in the presidential races. So they're under political pressure by the time we get to 1919 and 1920 to enfranchise women, to pass the 19th Amendment. So we can't understand how significant change happens if we say the 19th Amendment enfranchised American women, because we completely obliterate that earlier history of partial enfranchisement and, you know, one state at a time, which made it possible, that grassroots work that, you know, faces tons of reversals over time as well. We miss that altogether. But then also we miss the fact that millions of women remained barred from the polls after 1920. They're barred on other bases than sex,
right?
Because what the amendment says is that no state nor the federal government can deny the vote on the basis of sex. But go ahead and deny the vote to women on other bases, that would be fine, right? So as long as you're not violating the 15th Amendment explicitly or the 19th, states still have enormous power to deny the vote. And of course they do.
And what are some of those factors that continue to bar women from the right to vote after
1920?
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much. So one of the most obvious is that the amendment says no state or federal government may deny the vote on the basis of sex, but doesn't mention the territories. And so Puerto Rican women, for instance, Hawaiian women, are not enfranchised by the 19th Amendment. And the Hawaiian territorial legislature immediately then enfranchised women in Hawaii. But the Puerto Rican legislature refused. And so the Puerto Rican suffrage movement actually becomes larger and more powerful in the 1920s after the 19th Amendment than it had been before. It had been powerful. And in fact, you know, For this group, this is especially important. In Puerto Rico, in the pre-1920 period, the center of the suffrage struggle was the labor movement. Luisa Capetillo is one of the most important players there, and she convinces a labor federation to support women's suffrage. So in like 1908 or 1909. Mm-hmm. And so in Puerto Rico, the original movement for women's suffrage is especially centered in the labor movement. But then the 19th Amendment passes, and even though Puerto Ricans are citizens, they've been made citizens in 1917, women there are not enfranchised, and so they have to keep it up, and there are new organizations formed, and in 1929, they were so frustrated with the Puerto Rican legislature that the Puerto Rican suffragists turned to the U.S. Congress and said, these guys are never going to enfranchise us, we need you to do it, and Congress was actually on the verge of doing it, which moved the Puerto Rican territorial legislature to enfranchise literate women in 1929, but the movement had to continue, and all adult Puerto Rican women don't vote until 1935.
Whoa.
So there's a struggle that's still on the basis of sex that continues after 1920, and again, is completely obscured if we say that women got the vote. American women got the vote in 1920. But then, of course, I mean, a much more familiar set of communities are also excluded. So Native American women, about half, we think, of Native American women were not considered citizens in 1920, not until 1924, when there's the Indian Citizenship Act passes and is signed into law, do all American Indians become citizens. But even as that law was passing, and our exhibit down at the National Archives has documentation of this, even then, officials in the Bureau of Indian Affairs were very clear that even though citizenship is being granted to all Indians, many states will be denying them the vote, right? And so many states will say things like, well, you have to be a resident of the state to vote in the state. And if you're living on a reservation, you're not really a resident of the state. Or they'll say you have to be paying taxes in the state. And reservation Indians don't pay taxes to the state. Sometimes the language of Native Americans being wards of the state will be used to say that you're not eligible for suffrage because you're a ward of the state. So multiple states, this ranges from Maine and Minnesota to Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona, deny the vote. And that struggle continues into the 1950s, actually. Utah is the last, finally, to take explicit bars against Native American voting out of their state law. So there's one of the many exclusions. The most famous one, of course, is the exclusion of African American women in the South, who were excluded from the polls by the same means that African American men had largely been disfranchised by. So that includes things like poll taxes and unfairly administered literacy tests or understanding tests, brute violence, and the threat of economic reprisals. All those same methods are used against African American women's voting. But that doesn't mean that from the very get-go, African-American women in the South were not trying to vote. And Liette Gidlow is doing fantastic work on this. She's discovered just thousands upon thousands of Black women who went to try to register to vote. Some of them succeed. I mean, thousands actually succeed in the 1920s. But many, many more, of course, are turned away. And they are sending, those women are sending letters of complaint and protest to the President of the United States and to the Attorney General saying, I know I have the right to vote on the basis of the 14th, the 15th, and the 19th Amendment. And I am being denied my right. What are you going to do about it? And of course, as we found, we're doing the work for the suffrage exhibit down at the archives. We found the Attorney General's files are full of these complaints from African-American women in the 20s.
Wow.
It's just fantastic. And so that history of struggle, you know, is just completely continuous, right? The struggle that began in the mid-19th century for both voting rights for African-Americans and for women continues just in a direct line into the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s,
and 60s. Thinking about voting rights in the 1960s, of course.
Absolutely.
And the civil rights movement and how important voting was and how important voting rights remain today. Thinking about the state of Georgia, thinking about, you know, prison reform and giving inmates and former felons who have served their time but still, you know, have a hard time getting jobs and they still don't have voting rights. And it's this long continued struggle. So I guess, I mean, the other couple things that I recognize from your work is how you basically cited women's suffrage as a piecemeal struggle.
Oh, yes.
And also how other reform movements basically led to women's suffrage, influence women's suffrage, which you've already spoken to a little bit, but kind of pushing this into the 21st century, what are some of the lessons that can be learned, and also how other reform movements have influenced voting rights, kind of speculating ahead, if we can.
Fantastic. So I'm so glad that you this registered with you, because I think that piecemeal, the fact that there's actually, I mean, New Jersey enfranchised women in 1776, right, propertied women. In fact, in 1776, New Jersey enfranchised African-American men and women and immigrants not yet naturalized, all able to vote if you've got 50 pounds about worth of personal property. Doesn't even have to be real property, personal property. Incredibly broad for that moment, broad franchise. And we have evidence, and actually some better evidence has just come to the fore in the last few weeks. We know that women in New Jersey are actually voting in groups in the late 18th and early 19th century. But then the vote is taken away from all of those groups, African-Americans, property women, and immigrants not yet naturalized, in 1807.
How?
Taken away. There's a reinterpretation of the Constitution. And the decision is that, oops, this didn't really apply to anybody but white men. So you have these groups that have been voting, and it gets taken away. And so the struggle over women's voting rights and voting rights in general, of course, began with the founding of the Republic. And there have been these, you know, advances and these reversals and the partial suffrage. I mean, in 1838, a bunch of women in Kentucky, not all women, but some women in Kentucky get school suffrage, 1838. And then there's all kinds of battles about that over the course of the 19th century and into the 21st. School suffrage, maybe 25% of the states have women have school suffrage by the end of the 19th century. As I've mentioned, 15 states by the time we get to 1919, 15 states that fully enfranchise women or enfranchise them on the same basis as men. This is really a piecemeal struggle.
Right.
And it has reversals as well as successes. So you have the New Jersey case in 1807, but the Kentucky case of school suffrage, women in certain towns get suffrage. The number of towns increases. But then, there comes this moment where black women are voting so much in those school elections that Democrats think, oh my gosh, the Republicans are going to defeat us in all these school elections. So they take the vote away from women in those cities. And so then black and white women have to work together to regain school suffrage. Utah is another one of those cases. Utah, in the territory of Utah, the Mormons enfranchise women in 1870. And Congress is all upset because they don't approve of polygamy, and they think, oh, this can't be. And then, of course, you have these voters, activists, Mormon women voting. And Congress takes the vote away from women in Utah in 1887. They've been voting for 17 years, and they get it taken away by Congress. And then when Utah comes back into the Union, or comes into the Union as a state in 1896, the Mormons have renounced polygamy. And women are enfranchised in Utah in 1896.
Back and forth.
So that's the story of voting rights in the United States. And you see it, of course, the African-American case is exactly the same. The 15th Amendment would seem to have enfranchised African-American men. African-American men exercised enormous political power in the North and the South, especially the South. And then it is eroded. Those voting rights are eroded. You asked about the lessons for the 21st century. One of the lessons is, of course, that voting rights are maintained by struggle, retained by struggle, not just gained by struggle, and that Americans have been arguing about this and granting and taking away the vote constantly from the very beginning of the Republic. And so when we see things like voter suppression movements, limiting the kinds of IDs that you can bring to the polls, or taking the vote away from felons, shutting down early voting, having polling places that are so far away from people they can't get there.
Closing down polling places, forcing voters to re-register without notification.
All of that is a part of this longer history of constant negotiation or renegotiation and contest over the vote. So the main point really of the exhibit that I've worked on is that the 19th Amendment did not enfranchise American women. Millions had it before, millions still didn't have it after, and the struggle goes on.
I guess we can say voting rights is a constant struggle.
Yeah, I think you can definitely say that.
Well, Professor Muncy, thank you so much for joining us. This has been outstanding. We really can't thank you enough. A couple of quick plugs, that a friendly reminder that rightfully hers, American Women and the Vote, the exhibit done by Dr. Muncy and Dr. Marjorie Spruill from the history professor from the University of South Carolina, is on display at the National Archives through January 3rd, 2021. Our own exhibit, which is currently untitled, will be on display in Hornbeck Library in the ground floor sometime in August, I believe. Stay tuned for more information on that.
Can I also say that absolutely crucial to the exhibit down at the National Archives is Corrine Porter and Ray Ruskin. They are staff archivist and the staff designer. And Marjorie and I don't know anything about putting together, you know, designing an exhibit. We never could have done that. We were strictly there for content.
And this is downtown at Archives 1.
This is downtown at Archives 1.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Yes. And there were other historians who worked on this as well. Tiffany Gill, Anne Gordon also worked on this exhibit.
Well, thank you to all the historians and exhibit creators and designers involved. We know your work is not easy. This has been another segment of Cool Things in the Meany Archives, special edition. So, yep, till next time.
We were Polish, we were Irish, we were African and Jew, Italian and Latina, Chinese and Russian too. They tried to use our differences all apart, but the pain we felt together touched the bottom of our heart. We were there in the factories, we were there in the mills, we were there in the mines and came home to fix the meals. We were there on the picket line, we raised our voices loud.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHG on your favorite podcast app, and we hope you do. This week's music was We Were There by Bev Grant. Her multimedia performance about women's labor history will be performed at the Tacoma Busboys of Poets on Tuesday, March 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. by Elise Bryant and featuring members of the D.C. Labor Chorus. It's free, and you can get details and RSVP at dclabor.org. Click on calendar. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe, Daniel Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozek, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening, keep making history, and see you next time.
We were there on the picket line.